From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
The Media Project is underway. It's a hop. It's an opportunity, I say, an opportunity for a half hour of commentary and analysis and maybe even some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Always nice to see this distinguished panel, and especially you. And I reserve for you the title of chief.
Don't call me chief. You have to be our age, Alan, to understand
the That's what Perry White said.
Meaning of that. Perry White used to say that on the Superman show. Don't call me chief. Yeah.
Right.
My great friend David Griggs Jenner used to call me Perry, and I would always say, don't call me chief. Anyway.
And Ira Fussfeld looks a little like the guy who played,
I'm getting increasingly gray, and that's possible.
Ira Fussfeld is the longtime publisher, now emeritus, now retired, of the Kingston Daily Freeman in New York and its associated publications. Sir,
good day. Nice to see you all.
Good day, and you also. And Caitlin Brown is here from the College of St. Rose, the head of the journalism program there.
I think I'll be Lois Lane today.
Excellent. Lois, I always had a
Lois Lane
thing for Lois. Anyway,
okay, I won't be Lois.
Never mind.
Cool.
Okay. Hey, the Pulitzers are out. You know, this is our first show since the Pulitzer Prizes were announced. Always, you know, every year an epical event in journalism. The top award in Pulitzers always is considered to be the Public Service Award. That's the one that comes with the gold medal. And that was actually shared in this case by the New York Times and the New Yorker, now that magazines are also eligible for Pulitzers. And that had to do with the reporting that led to the hashtag MeToo movement by, at the Times, Jody Cantor, Megan Tuohy, Emily Steele, and Michael Schmidt, and at The New Yorker, the remarkable reporting by Ronan Farrow. So quite something.
You were a judge, right, at one time? Not this year.
A juror, yes.
Now, do they literally vote and there's a point system, or is it an amazing coincidence that there is a tie? I don't remember ever there being a tie.
Well, the way that this works is the juries review all of the stuff that's submitted, hundreds of submissions, and you literally sit there and read all this stuff. It is days of reading together as a group, and a jury is typically five members on each category: public service, breaking news reporting, local reporting, explanatory, that kind of thing. And then the juries submit three finalists to the Pulitzer Prize Board, an esteemed group that includes journalists, the president of Columbia University, novelists. It's a really significant group of, say, two dozen people, and the board then makes a decision. So what you find in public service, for example, there are two winners and a separate finalist, the Kansas City Star, and what that means is probably the board decided that they couldn't choose between these two, and so they went, both of them were equally deserving, so they went forward with this. The board also, one more thing, moves items from one category to another. So there was evidence of that, for example. They don't talk about these deliberations, by the way.
Almost as secretive as the Oscar voting.
It is, but there was one photo category where there was a winner and three finalists. And then another photo category had one finalist and one winner. So they probably moved somebody from one category to another and gave it the award. So it's just an interesting thing.
Well, I have my annual complaint about the Pulitzer Prizes, and not that I didn't win one because I'm no longer active.
Well, that's my complaint.
But the complaint is, where is the Pulitzer for sports writing? They almost never award a sports writer. I believe there have been three in the history of the Pulitzers, one to Arthur Daly, one to Jim Murray, I think, and one to Dave Anderson.
Red Smith?
Not even sure, but he may have. Point is, why isn't there one every year?
Well, maybe because sports are not important.
Yeah, but sports writing is, historically, many people believe the best writing in the newspaper is in the sports department.
Mm-hmm.
perhaps it's not always award-winning.
Well, I guess, according to the Pulitzers, it's almost never award-winning, which just stuns me.
It would have to, I guess, fall into the category of feature writing, right? I think that's about the
I
only
I know there is a sports, well, there
work.
Used to be a sports writing category.
Yeah.
Well,
hmm.
Could fall under breaking news, for instance.
Well,
there was a big brawl on the mound, and you know, which happened recently, and they decided
exactly.
that was the story worthy of an award.
Well, certainly, you know, whoever it was who exposed the drug culture of Major League Baseball 20
yeah,
years
right,
ago
right.
would have deserved a Pulitzer,
yep.
right?
Well, who uses a spitter, you know, that kind of thing.
But in the meantime, it's excellent that the stories that resulted in the Me Too movement did win the Pulitzer. And it's an excellent idea, I think, on the part of the jury that they had the New Yorker and the New York Times win together because they were equally deserving for the coverage that they shared with a willing readership who now is taking action.
For investigative reporting, the Washington Post won for its reporting about Roy Moore, which really upended the Alabama special election. And for national reporting, that again was shared by the staffs of the New York Times and the Washington Post for their reporting on Russia's influence in the 2016 election.
Yeah, right.
Of note with that Roy Moore coverage is the reporters talked fairly extensively about the shoe leather reporting they did and how often they met face-to-face with their sources to verify. I think that's what distinguished that reporting. And then they shared all of the reporting and how that took place. So they were especially transparent with readers to let them understand how this story was developed.
You know, it's so interesting to me, Chief Rex. here's what. I think that papers like yours, and I know you hire investigative reporters and they do wonderful work. And the Berkshire Eagle, for example, has Larry Parnas, who's a terrific reporter and who broke a major story and did a lot of leather, shoe leather work and went down south because the guy who was trying to sell the art at the Berkshire Museum had done the same thing down south. This guy was able to nail it all down. I thought it was Pulitzer material and kept saying so in my columns and stuff. But, you know, how can they possibly get to all of the local papers that are doing Pulitzer quality work? You know, like yours, Rex.
Oh, wow.
I asked that question only to get you involved.
only to butter up the host. No, it's very Gee. Kind of you. It's a, you know, it is hard for a smaller paper, smaller I say than the New York Times and the Washington Post with their hundreds of people in the newsroom, to emerge. And I feel as though there may well be a story someday that we could qualify for, but it's hard to do Pulitzer level work. I'll tell you, having been a juror, that it really is tremendously competitive. And when you win it, it's significant. Sometimes the smaller papers win it for breaking news reporting. The Press Democrat in Santa Rosa, California, won for coverage of the wildfires in October, and they beat my sister newspaper, the Houston Chronicle, which did its coverage of the flooding in Houston, the hurricane, which was significant. And they beat the staff of the New York Times in breaking news reporting. So that can happen. And sometimes you get a smaller paper where you get one really great writer. They oftentimes, honestly, I hate to say this, but it's like the people sitting on Morningside Heights in New York at Columbia to give this award will look down and say, oh, let's give it to a little paper. And they find some editorialists they like. And
well,
know.
No, that's right, Rex. I was going to say that. Chief, I mean, you stole my thunder because I really think that the easy one to give away a Pulitzer for is an editorial. An editorial writer, which is often written by one person, let's face it. And then you can give it to a small paper because you have a bright person writing editorials there.
Like the Glens Falls Post-Star when Mark Mahoney won not that long ago, several years ago, but Mark Mahoney, who wrote editorials for the Glens Falls Post-Star, was awarded the Pulitzer for editorial writing.
And as Rex always points out, the Berkshire Eagle won, what, 1954 or something like that?
Roughly, yes.
Yeah.
It was great.
So we remember that. I always say...
People always remember it, yes.
It's well, memorable. Winning the Pulitzer is great. Quite an honor.
It may just be we're preaching to the choir, but I thought that the Pulitzers were particularly important this year, given the drumbeat of about fake news coming out of the Washington, halls of Washington and the right wing. And although the Pulitzer Prizes may not convince those who believe that fake news is fake news, isn't fake news, I think it still needs to be reinforced about how much good work is going on in this country at newspapers large and small.
One of the things that Kalen alluded to was the Post's Pulitzer for the Roy Moore. What was unusual there was that they really showed how the reporting was going on. You remember in that reporting, the Post revealed that while the president was attacking the fake news of the Washington Post, The fact is, the folks in Alabama did robocalls to Alabama residents from a non-existent Post reporter. They made up a name, Bernie Bernstein.
Wasn't that through the Project Veritas group, and O'Keefe, who visited Siena?
Yes, who came to Siena College, right, this really fake news purveyor, literally fake news purveyor, James O'Keefe. They said, we'll give you $5,000 or $7,000 to any woman who will come forward with dirt on Roy Moore. Well, so it was an effort to discredit the Post reporting, and they tried to entrap the Post into reporting on a fake victim, and instead the Post videotaped its reporter on the Moore story, exposing the Project Veritas operative.
Do you think there was any anti-Semitism involved in Bernie Bernstein?
You think?
I think so.
Yeah.
You playing to a particular, maybe, Alabama crowd?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, prizes aren't everything. We sometimes, I think, are rightly criticized in journalism for being a little bit wedded and self-impressed by our prizes. But it's a wonderful thing. The Pulitzers in particular are considered signifiers of real accomplishment. And because it's a national competition and because the best of the best are in there, it really is a cool thing to recognize.
When you talk about the struggle with local news being eligible for Pulitzers, local news doesn't often have the same sort of resources that the bigger organizations like the New York Times and the Washington Post have. Recent records or recent data and reports are showing that continually there is an increased subscription rate online for the New York Times and the Washington Post. So they're more able to support the journalism and free reporters up for sometimes months to cover these sorts of stories.
Absolutely. And when I was young and worked for a very rich newspaper when Newsday had a lot of money, I remember I spent 11 months on a single story from start to publication. And we didn't win a Pulitzer that year. They thought that we might, but it was one of the years that the Philadelphia Inquirer won at Bartlett and Steele, that great investigative reporting team won.
But still, 11 months on
11
a story
months.
Is notable.
Who
and
could do
it's
that?
Heavenly for a reporter.
Even harder in a smaller paper. I can recall some years ago, we turned a reporter loose for a month to report a series of stories on drugs. And as a result, she was not covering her regular beats for a month. And when you have a smaller newsroom, that's a big hole to. And so you have to make a big decision at some point. Is it worth the effort and the payoff to get that reporter free for a month to do this? Or do we need her or him to do what they normally do?
You know, Ira, you raise an interesting question here. There is, of course, a major epidemic in this country, and that is heroin and
the opioid crisis.
Yeah,
yes.
Opioid. And there are newspapers that are spending a tremendous amount of time on it, but it hasn't caught on yet the way that it ought to with the public, because it is, everybody knows somebody who has had, you know, had this problem. So I want to go back to you, Rex, and Chief, and ask you about whether or not this business is that the Pulitzer committees say, okay, we're going to decide what the most important stories were of the year, like Trump and this and that, and eschew some of the ones that may even be more serious for the American character.
Well, there are two answers to that. First, the Pulitzer Prize for Local Reporting, just now announced, went to the staff of the Cincinnati Inquirer, which did an amazing multimedia narrative of 7 days inside Cincinnati's heroin epidemic. They turned...
Okay, I take it back.
Okay. They put out 60 reporters. Now, of course, I don't have 60 reporters in my newsroom, but they put 60 reporters out, and they did 7 days inside the heroin epidemic. It was just heroic local reporting, really. It was stunning stuff. And so kudos to the Cincinnati Inquirer staff. And they tracked the fact that, you know, 18 people died, 180 overdose victims were reported. So we are undertaking, we have...
I've seen it.
This, the
Good
Times
work.
Union has commissioned this effort, and we are sharing the data with all the other media. Anybody who wants it can join Prescription for Progress, taking on the opioid epidemic in our community. It's not going to win a Pulitzer because the creative stuff was done by the Cincinnati Inquirer, but it is the day in and day out ground level reporting, the daily commitment to watchdog journalism, to intrepid reporting is really what is at the core of local journalism. And that is hard to sustain as staffs are shrinking. You know, that's the complaint, actually, to turn to another story we do need to address. That's the complaint out in Denver, where the staff of the Denver Post has had this extraordinary insurrection against its owner, the capital fund, Alton Capital, the hedge fund. That is where they're complaining their staff has just shrunk to so small that they can't even do the day in, day out accountability reporting that's required.
Well, and the Los Angeles Daily News, which is part of another paper in that group, is beginning to see the rumblings from its staff as well. They've been printing, I believe their editor printed a column explaining what's going on. It's interesting on a number of levels. There was a story in the Columbia Journalism Review about this. In fact, the editor of my former paper was quoted pointing out, we only have 12 people in our newsroom. I mean, I'm happy I'm not there any longer.
How many did you have in the day?
Oh, in the day we had between 30 and 35. There used to be a number that was used that you should have one person per 1,000 circulation.
Right.
And we, at our high watermark, we had a 31,000 papers on Sunday. And now, of course, it's a fraction of that. And I just find, personally, I just cringe at what I see in my old newspaper, and it has nothing to do with the great work that those who are remaining are doing, because they're all working harder than ever, but it's just impossible to maintain quality when you have that small a number of people on the staff. And the Alden Group is a hedge fund, they're vulture capitalists, and they buy properties to squeeze them to death and drain as much money as they can out of them. And the only thing that I do think that I don't see talked about regarding this is, if blame is the right word, where does the blame lie among those who sell the properties to the vulture capitalists? In other words, we're hearing people say, well, the vulture capitalists, they're not newspaper people. They don't care what they're doing, so they're just going to drain the property. Well, presumably their former owners were newspaper people, and they were put in a position perhaps where they had no choice but to sell to Alden. But recently, Alden purchased the Boston Herald, and I know that it had at least one other large competitive bid, and the owners sold Boston Herald to Alden. Well, if you're going to let a bull run free in a china shop, don't be surprised if the china gets broken, and that's what's going on now.
I mean, you know, money talks, all of us walk. It really does come down to that, right? You say that they should consider the potential consequences.
I think it depends. I mean, if an owner of a newspaper is losing money and the newspaper is heading towards bankruptcy, and so they put it up for sale and the only bidder is Alden, well, that's a tough choice to turn down their money. But I just think that those who see what Alden is doing and are surprised and shocked by it should not be either shocked or surprised by it. Mm-hmm.
It is hard because we say here on this show, and we all believe that journalism is a public trust, that if you are the owner of a local journalism enterprise or you're the operator of one in the case of a public radio station, for example, you have an obligation to the community. And, you know, it's kind of like a farmer who says in the encroaching suburbia, looks out and says, you know, my last crop is going to be homes. I'm going to sell this to a developer.
Sure.
And, you know, we hate to see this beautiful farmland be swallowed up by homes, but you can sympathize with the farmer who says, here's my payday. Here's my chance to endow my family for future years.
Well, yes, but the other side of that is that we in Great Barrington have exactly the opposite.
Yes.
People are buying people's homes, and the people go to Florida, and their kids are complaining that there's no place to buy, an affordable place to buy anymore.
Are those kids buying newspapers?
Oh, so you think that's the difference?
Well, no. I just think that young people need it. That's where we need to build newspapers back up.
I hear you.
News sources. That we need people who have resources, and young people between 18 and 34. There's some data that shows that increasingly they are subscribing digitally to newspapers. So we need to keep encouraging that, and hopefully that will result in more better journalism.
Absolutely. You know, we were talking last week about local ownership helping to revive the Berkshire Eagle in Alan's hometown and other newspapers, the hope that somebody locally will come along. There's talk of this now in Denver. There's a consortium coming together in Denver to see if they can buy the paper. And Alden Capital, I'm sure, is just licking their chops and saying, hey, great. Look at all this bad publicity. Maybe we'll get a higher price.
If there's anything left of their assets to sell. I mean, the squeezing is so tight that the properties are not nearly as valuable as they once were. And this is entirely apart from factors that Alden has nothing to do with, as newspapers were declining. I mean, my newspaper company's circulation was starting to go down long before Alden came in the picture, as was virtually everybody.
So yeah. I want to make one point, though, because I've made it before, Rex. We're lucky, in my opinion, we're lucky in Berkshire County because the Berkshire Eagle has come along, gotten a group of really good-minded investors, and they put it together, and they're running a fairly good, very good newspaper. Whereas, you know, a Trumpista or a McCarthyista, or one of those guys could come in along and say, okay, I'm going to put a group together too.
Yes.
And I'm going to be dictating the editorial policy, and that could be just as bad as anything else we see.
It is not always true that corporate ownership is bad. I point to my own company, Hearst, which is a global enterprise, which held on to and sustained the San Francisco Chronicle for years and years, losing millions and millions of dollars until they turned it into a profitable enterprise just a couple of years ago. So sometimes out-of-town ownership actually does make a difference. But, you know, there are an awful lot of places where you hope for local control coming back in to sustain an enterprise.
Well, and corporate ownership at one time when the industry was stronger, there was an emphasis on journalism. You know, they may have been penny pinchers and they may have been looking to cut corners financially. But I know my former company prior to Alden, the Journal Register Company, which had a reputation as bad as any in the industry for cost cutting, they had people involved who were editorial types, an editorial vice president. They very much wanted us to win contests and do good journalism. Now, they didn't make it easy for us because we didn't have a lot of resources, but this was a corporation that did believe in journalism after a fashion. You don't see that now. I'd ask the editors and the academics in the room, what do you think about this movement by the staff in Denver and now seemingly in Los Angeles, and it may spread elsewhere, where they're running these stories about their ownership in a negative fashion, apparently without the owners knowing that these stories are going to appear until they pick up the paper
It's your newspaper that we're talking about. It's one of the group. Why don't you tell us what you think about that?
I think it's very brave of them, because if I was... Well, I'll turn it around to you. If you driving in from the Berkshires one morning and turned on WAMC and you heard your news department run a negative story about WAMC without your prior notice, that would get your attention at the very least. And I'm sure you would, as I'm sure it would Mr. Hearst.
Yes.
And in the old days, we both worked when you were with the Troy Record, right? You know, Bob Jelinek, you know, I guarantee you that would be the first phone call I would get as the publisher if the corporation was criticized.
I think it suggests how disassociated Alden Capital is from journalism, that these people can get away with it.
Because, we'll see whether they get away with it.
They might have felt that there was nothing to lose.
That's probably
they
right.
They recognized an injustice, too.
Yeah.
They recognize an injustice. That's what journalists do. They see an injustice within their own house, and they say, we can't just sit by and let this die.
That is so foo-foo of you.
It is not foo-foo.
I think I was right. They saw the end coming. They were firing everybody. They said, we're going to do this before it's us.
Don't name call, Alan.
That's not a bad name.
You're aligning yourself with other name callers. You don't want to be aligned with name callers.
I want to issue an abject apology.
Our listener Sharon from Scotia says that with regard to discussion of the last show, that we should think about Facebook as a platform for journalism. Facebook itself does not produce news, but it provides a platform for news outlets to share the work. So when someone says they get their news from Facebook, as I often do, she says it depends on whom they follow. Of course, she follows the New York Times and the Washington Post, she says, and many legitimate sources. She says this: there are plenty of fake news items that show up on Facebook. It's incumbent upon individuals to be able to distinguish real news from fake news, and we should be teaching it to high school seniors in their politics and government class.
You love that letter, don't you?
Yes, and I wasn't here last week to vote, but let the record show that Facebook is not journalism. I agree with Kalen and Rex.
They are
a platform. They publish news, but none. And just like the aggregation news sites, they publish the work of others, but they don't produce any of their own journalism.
Wrong. The fact of the matter is, people are getting their information there, and it is just as much of a journal as anything else that you
is the guy
read.
Who sells the newspaper on Broadway and 86th Street in a little stand. Is he a journalist? He sells the newspapers.
No,
he passes along the information. He has nothing to do with producing that information. You pick up one of the, you look at one of those aggregation news sites, and you're seeing the hard work of Rex's newspaper, of my newspaper, maybe even of WAMC their website.
No. Well, I like it when we're there.
Well, but, you may like it, but they're not journalists who are producing it.
Our listeners paying for their journalism. That's a question
of conscience.
That's
a new definition of journalism?
No, that's how journalism gets made, by being paid for. So we have an obligation to pay for the journalism we want.
Yeah.
Pay money. There's no such thing as a paywall, just like there's no such thing as FN. Rather, it's a subscription. You pay for a service. When you go to the grocery and you want milk, you pay for it. That's not a paywall, that cashier.
3-1. I don't like it.
With that fine statistic, we will close off the Media Project. Kaylin Brown and Ira Fussfeld and Alan Shartok, and I'm Rex Smith, with gratitude to our producer, David Gustina, and to you all for joining us this week on the Media Project.
Funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give 3 cheers for freedom of the press.